In 2016, as Americans went to the polls, the top voting issues for Republicans were the economy, terrorism, immigration, foreign policy, and health care. Democratic voters rallied around the economy and terrorism as well. However, their point of view on those topics differed significantly from GOP supporters. The other top Democratic issues were racial mistreatment, gun control, and the environment. 2 years into the Trump administration, Americans are heading into midterm elections. The results could shift the balance of power in both the House and the Senate. Currently, the Republicans hold the balance of power in both chambers. What issues are Americans wrestling with currently? The economy appears to be on fire. Terrorism is slipping from the headlines. Trump has taken on China, Europe, Canada, and Mexico in trade, and he is getting much of what he wanted. He's already appointed 2 judges to the Supreme Court. So what next? What issues are front and center? Crime, the unequal distribution of wealth, poverty, access to education and health care, along with the rising cost of living, all are ever present. But are they the lightning rod issues that will tip the results of an election? We invited both Nikkele Ambrose, the newly elected Republican national chairwoman, and Mark Hetherington, a political scientist at the University of North Carolina, to join us for a conversation that matters about the issues they say will play important roles in how Americans cast their ballots this November.
Conversations That Matter is a partner program for the Center for Dialogue at Simon Fraser University. The production of this program is made possible thanks to the support of the following and viewers like you.
Welcome. What are some of the issues that Americans are grappling with right now as they get ready to head to the polls for the midterm elections? You're representing a Republican perspective, you're representing a Democratic perspective. When we looked at the 2016 election, terrorism, the economy were the two top issues, and probably from both perspectives. Share with me now what you think are the main issues right now that are on Americans' minds as they're getting ready to go to the polls.
It's changed since the beginning of September. So Republicans and a lot of independents in the middle have gotten very emotional and upset, which is not so normal for our side, about the Brett Kavanaugh hearings and how they were conducted and what we perceive as the games that were played and the lack of due process, which is, you know, a central part of our judicial system and American way of life. The anger affiliated with how those Kavanaugh hearings went down have set a fire under our base. And if you look at polling, we have a 12-point increase in base enthusiasm now for this election, with people saying it's very important. That's not usual for midterms. So with this sudden Republican enthusiasm to vote because of the outright rage and anger about how the Kavanaugh thing played out, I think it's going to be very close. I don't necessarily think you're going to see a blue wave at all. I think you're going to see a red wave in the Senate, but the map was naturally favorable to Republicans this cycle.
Because of the seats that were in for contention.
Yeah. They were seats that Trump won in some cases by double digits. So even with a slight decrease in popularity or the pendulum swinging in states like North Dakota, in states like Missouri, it was likely that a Republican could pick those up. But now that our base is enthused, absolutely. The Democrats on the other side, for example, the most mobilized and motivated group has been the women who wear pink hats, and we have factored that in and expected them to vote.
So is Brett Kavanaugh the issue, or is it anger? Because anger was ever present in the 2016 presidential election as well.
It is Brett Kavanaugh, and I think it's a kind of a coalescence of a lot of concerns. It's a coalescence of people feel that there's not a level system of justice. And on the Republican side, it's very important that we feel there's a fair playing field. So whether it was Hillary Clinton not being prosecuted for something anyone else would end up in jail for, or whether it's Brett Kavanaugh not being allowed to defend himself against accusations. And just so you know what Republicans heard, we heard simply because he was accused, he was guilty. So guilt by accusation. And I can't tell you how many Democrats would say, oh, just trot out another person. He's done. He's done. Just trot out another person. I said, What if it's you? What if you're innocent? Don't you think you have a right to defend yourself? And if you take down one person like that, who's to say they can't take out you next that way? So it was that concept of lack of due process and just writing off someone's entire life that was very offensive, not only to the Republican base, but a lot of independents as well.
From your perspective, what do you see as the issues as we head into the...
I think one of the big problems that we have in the United States these days is the issues hardly matter anymore. It's all about partisanship. We have a situation right now in the U.S. where people honestly believe what they want to believe as opposed to what's necessarily true. We have a moment in history like we've never seen before. 7-8 pipe bombs in the mail to Democratic politicians. You know, this is a crazy, awful, and, you know, really disquieting time in American politics. It's going to be governed completely by emotion. You know, you made reference to anger. There's tremendous anger on both sides. The anger is directed towards those who are on the other political side as far as their partisanship is concerned. Democrats are incredibly fired up. They have been for the last 2 years because of the Trump presidency and, you know, all of the malign things he tends to say and do and tweet and things along those lines.
Do you think that that's going to motivate Democrats to go out to the polls? Because as you pointed out, turnout in midterm elections is typically lower than when it's in a presidential.
Well, they always are. Usually the difference is, you know, high 50s for the presidential elections, mid-30s for midterm elections. I suspect we will see not presidential-level turnout. That's not going to happen in this in a midterm election. But we'll see much higher than usual turnout in, and this is true both from Republicans and from Democrats, because, you know, Republicans are upset too for exactly the reasons that Nicolee pointed out. Mm-hmm. But the emotion that people are feeling right now, and all you have to do is log into your social media to actually just palpably feel it. I mean, you know, if you want to think about it, what happened yesterday was, you know, 7 or 8.
There's been nine pipe bombs.
So nine attempted assassinations, political assassinations. That's, you know, one way of looking at it. Mm-hmm. These are bombs. They're supposed to kill people. Are you kidding me that that's not going to cause a tremendous amount of enthusiasm for the people who have been attacked? I suspect that it will. My sense of things is not actually all that different from Nicolee's as it relates to what the results are going to be. She's 100% right that the Senate map is not particularly advantageous to Democrats because of the places where the races are taking place. And keep in mind, the reason for that is because these elections that are taking place now are the seats that came up 6 years ago when Barack Obama won the presidency in 2012.
Right.
So Democrats won a number of seats they probably wouldn't have otherwise won without his coattails. But with that in mind, Republicans should do better than expected. They may pick a seat up or two or something along those lines. But in the House is where, you know, this really boils down. And, you know, you look at the direction that the Republic is taking right now.
At the moment, I look at the U.S. economy and I go, okay, it is on fire. Mm-hmm. What happened? Democrats will say, well, that's the, you know, the living out of the policies of Barack Obama. But Republicans will say, no, Donald Trump has actually gone about making things happen.
Yeah, and this is part of the problem. You're exactly right. Mm-hmm. One of the things I mentioned earlier is we see the world the way we want to see it rather than the way that it really is. Mm-hmm. And Democrats right now don't want to provide Donald Trump with any credit at all. And it's ridiculous. The administration has created an extraordinary economy. But what I would suggest is the economy is not the only way to judge a leader. You know, whether a leader, you know, inflames tensions in the country, mocks sexual assault victims from the stump, fans the flames of lock her up chants. I mean, this is mob. This is mobocracy. This is mob rule. Calls the news media the enemy of the state. You know, it's great that the economy has been terrific, but, you know, Mussolini was pretty good at getting the trains to run on time, too. Didn't make him a good guy.
What's your response to that?
So I think one of the very motivating factors, in addition to the Kavanaugh hearings, is how the Democratic far left handled and behaved on the streets and the halls of Capitol Hill during that hearing. So this mob rule thing is a huge issue to Republicans, because when we see naked women running around screaming, when we see tape all over their body, but everywhere else they're naked, when you see this group think, when you hear our coastal elites in New York City to LA saying that if you have a different opinion on any issue, on any issue. Mm-hmm. You are somehow subhuman. America doesn't work this way. So these are true things that deeply concern Americans, and I think are attracting a lot of Republicans, excuse me, a lot of independents to vote for Republican candidates who are just like, common sense, this is crazy. These people are not behaving civilly. On the other hand, at the same time, speaking of the economy, we had, I believe, a very kind of suppressed economy. It was very overregulated in the years of Barack Obama. My monthly expenses as a single mother of two kids went up $2,000 a month. How can most people afford that? That was a huge issue. When we talk about anger, I was angry. How on earth could, because of government intervention, I have to pay $2,000 more a month in monthly expenses? It was outrageous.
This is the problem that we have in the U.S. We want to see it the way we want to see it.
That is the whole concept around worldview. I see the world from my perspective this way going forward.
Yeah, and this is, but this is poisonous, you know, and this is poisonous for a lot of different reasons. It's poisonous from the perspective of the fact that there are facts. And democracies rely on people working from the same facts. Even more problematic, I think, and this is something that Nick Laney and I have had the opportunity to talk about a lot during the course of this week, you know, Republicans and Democrats simply are not pulling on the same rope anymore.
But were they ever? You know,
for decades and decades, Republicans and Democrats pulled on the same rope from the New Deal through about the year 2000. We've always had parties. We've always had divisions. But one of the things that makes America different from a lot of different countries was that there was a political middle that would come together and provide a moderate way that made America what it was.
Well, sure, and we saw that political middle exist probably up through to the end of the Clinton administration.
Yes,
and
that's
from that point on,
where it goes
it's
down
as
now.
Though it became a split, 50-50.
I think the first completely toxic example of our kind of Congress behaving badly was the Clarence Thomas hearings. And then we had a bit of a reprieve, and now it operates like that frequently. One thing that I'm dismayed about, that I wish we were unified about on all issues pertaining to, is really foreign affairs. I really appreciate when Democrats and Republicans can speak with a more united voice and try not to undermine each other there. That is one thing, I think. But I'm going to disagree with Mark here on this. And that is, when Republicans sat there and said, I do not want Barack Obama to be reelected because I disagree with him on policy, that is a fair political argument. Mm-hmm. And I'm happy to make that argument day in and day out. And obviously, he does the reverse. It is different when you are maligning and attacking people's personal life, threatening them, when you have Hillary Clinton saying she cannot be civil to someone of another party, when you have Eric Holder saying to kick people, and when you have Maxine Waters giving floor speeches on the House of Representatives saying you should go after Republican elected officials simply because they were Republican wherever you can find them. And I have friends, Representative Steve Scalise, who nearly lost his life on that baseball field. The only reason all of those other teammates of his were alive, like Senator Rand Paul on that day, was because Scalise was in leadership and happened to have two security detail with him.
As you both bring up these points, I am reminded of the fact that when I every now and then tune in and watch sort of the discourse that is happening in American politics, I think nobody's having a conversation. People are talking at one another, but nobody's hearing one another.
You're right.
And how do we get beyond that? How do we get to the point where I can say, okay, because I can listen to you right now and go, yeah, you're making some valid points.
Sure.
And same with you. You're making valid points. And I'm willing to adjust my thinking a little bit. But what I'm watching play itself out is, comes back to where we started. People are angry, and so they're going to say, I'm going to browbeat you into accepting my position. How do we get beyond that? How do you get beyond that in the United States?
Let me ask you a question. I know that you're the interviewer, but let me ask you a question. Who do you think is the person who sets the tone in the United States for the dialogue that we have? President of the United States does.
Well, he has the bully pulpit. There's no doubt about it.
Nobody has a larger platform. And, you know, what we're seeing since he's been elected is an escalation of all of these things, up to and including these horrific threats and carrying out of violent acts, which is one of the things that we absolutely shouldn't have. I mean, you know, think about this. If we read in the newspaper that 9 pipe bombs were delivered to members of the opposition party in some other country, what would our reaction be? We'd be thinking we're reading about Guatemala or Romania or something like that. But it's happened in the United States of America.
Mm-hmm.
And how we get out of this? Well, you know, hopefully we get some good political leadership from the very top that tamps down these types of things. You know, think about what Donald Trump's reaction to the pipe bombs was. What did he do? He blamed the media.
Mm-hmm.
That is a lack of moral authority.
I don't have the answer for that. I'm as bewildered as anybody else as to how we wind our way out of this, because I don't think he's alone in inciting this level or this type of discourse.
I don't think that anybody would be
above
of the mind that would suggest that anybody takes it to a higher level than he ever has.
There's no doubt he's been a game changer.
The types of things that he has called for, jailing of political opponents, deriding judges because of, you know, where they come from, you know, even when one who's, you know, supposedly Mexican, but is in fact from Chicago, you know, chanting for, you were talking about the crowds. The crowds are one of the things that I think worries me more than anything. It's not just the president. You know, when he makes fun of a sexual assault victim and the crowd roars, there is something very wrong going on in the United States.
And I hear exactly what you're saying, and I agree with all of those elements, but you are able to cite similar types of incendiary behavior from the other side.
They're not similar
at
all.
I completely disagree.
They don't come from political leaders. Tell me when the Nancy Pelosi
So when Eric Holder, an attorney general, the chief law enforcement officer of the United States, says kick people because they're Republicans? That's physical violence. That is a physical act. Kick to a verb, which is a physical act. So I want to give you hope. I want to give you some hope here. So I live in the state of Maryland. It is a 2.3 Democrat to every one Republican state.
Mm-hmm.
And we have the most popular Republican governor in the nation at 76%, mm-hmm. Larry Hogan. Second most popular governor in the nation is also from a blue state, Charlie Baker in Massachusetts. And I live in Baltimore City, right? You all think of Baltimore for riots. It's actually a beautiful city you can visit. But it is in Baltimore has 85% Democrats, and yet Governor Hogan has like 55% approval rate in Baltimore City. And I talk with Democrats all the time. I am a minority in my city, clearly, as a Republican who lives in an 85% Democrat city. And, you know, we have different, you know, in America, the states are the incubators, right, of ideas and the farms.
Okay, so let me ask you, based on the environment that you live in or the demographics of where you live in, can you go to a dinner party and have the kind of dialogue that doesn't get into being accusatory?
So, the great question. I would much prefer to go hang out at, I have to tell you, some of my greatest friends in Baltimore are with the NAACP. Love them. Have a great time. After the Freddie Gray riots, I trotted down to Sandtown and went to the NAACP office there, and they were doing great work. They're very accepting of me. We can have great conversations. Who's not accepting are the limo liberals, the Hillary Clinton, John Kerry types. If you disagree with them on one single issue. So, like, for example, it's impossible to be a pro-life Democrat these days and tell them they will go after you. I mean, I'm a Republican, so I don't have these problems. In the Republican Party, we're much more accepting. We're used to people who, oh, I'm a fiscal conservative, oh, I'm a social conservative, oh, I'm a libertarian, and we're much more accepting. It's a little harder for turnout because if someone is upset in one of those areas, they just won't vote. So we have a much harder base turnout problem, I feel it's much easier for me to operate.
And yet my perception from afar is that Republicans are much more along the lines of either you're with us or you're
against.
I think you should ask Jeff Flake how he feels about that. A guy who had the most conservative voting record in the entire House of Representatives in the early 2000s, all of a sudden is somebody that Republicans deride and make fun of because of one thing that he did.
And
how about John McCain?
And I, as a woman, find Jeff Flake's behavior disgraceful.
Really?
I find
That's
him
great.
Completely disingenuous.
So I guess he's off of the team then.
I find him dishonest. He was dishonest.
He lied
to Republicans. He lied to his colleagues. What kind of a person are you to lie to colleagues you've worked with for like 20 years? It's like a special level of bad character. I just found him to be lacking in character.
Because I'm going to run out of time here.
I think that, you know, we're at this point where we're saying, okay, my views are entrenched, and how do we get beyond that? How do we in North America, because what happens in the United States affects us in Canada, and I see it happening here too. How do we get to that point where we're able to talk to one another, find areas of acceptance in the gray area of life, and say, okay, we're in this together. We all want to have a better country and a better quality of life for ourselves and for our children. How do we get there?
This is the big concern that I raise actually in my research. And you know, Nickley and I have had, you know, our disagreements around the table today, and we've been together for the last, you know, 3.5 days, and I would say that we've actually enjoyed each other.
It was clear to me that you get along quite well.
Yeah,
and this is, I think, the point, and the fact that Nickley does the work that she does in the communities that she works in Baltimore is the key. The problem that we have in the United States these days is, you know, across the political aisle, we don't have enough contact with each other. We've gotten sorted out in a way that the liberals live in the city and the conservatives live in the country. And as a result of that, we just become caricatures to each other. If Nickley and I didn't spend 3.5 days together, we would have been caricatures of each other. We would have looked at each other on this program and thought, what is going on with this crazy person?
So it comes down to good old human interaction.
Oh, don't you think? It's like people to people, but needs to be done within America, honestly. Yeah. It's like the old Eisenhower program that needs to be implemented. Yeah. You just have this issue with, we were talking about this the other day, the coastal elites saying the rest of America is flyover country. Mm-hmm. And that is not healthy.
I've been thinking about a turn of phrase. I don't know if it makes any sense at all, but it's this. You know, this partisanship is killing us. It's totally doing us in for the reasons that you've seen, you know, during the course of this conversation. We as partisans need to find a way to stand apart from that partisanship. We need to do it on both sides, and we need to stand together from our differences.
Well,
I don't know how we get there, but we need to do that. That's the map.
Well, I think all of us who live outside of the United States hope that you find that path forward. Thank you very much for coming in and doing this.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.